If I were to list the reasons why my marriage ended, my lesbianism would be like number nine.
This is Heart of the Story, and I'm Nadine Kenny Johnstone. I'm an author and a holistic writing coach who talks with today's top women writers about how to navigate life when things don't go according to plan. These impactful conversations and personal reflections invite you to be seen, feel supported, and ultimately fall back in love with yourself. So let's go together to that honest, powerful place, the heart of the story. Hi, friends. Ooh, you're going to love today's conversation. I am speaking with author, editor, and teacher, Susanna Daniel. She has written three novels. Her first, Stiltsville, was awarded the Penn Bingham Prize. Her second novel, Sea Creatures, was a Target Book Club pick. And her third novel, Girlfriending, was just published. And I absolutely loved it. And so today we cover a lot of ground, but the main focus was on this world of autofiction. What is it like to write a novel from real life events? And what is it like to write about real life characters? And so Susanna talks about how the writing process of this book was very different from the writing process of her first two novels that were published. And she also talks about what it's like to give her real life characters a viewing of the manuscript before it goes to the publishers. So this really, really fascinated me because it feels like tricky territory when you're writing about real life people. Do you show them the manuscript? Do you not? To whom do you show it? What do you say when you give it to them? What are you willing to change or not change? This is really layered, tricky territory, and Susanna covers her process and what she did and the surprises about what she heard back from her real life characters. We really dive in deep with this one. We also talk about how to find freedom as a midlife woman with a lot of responsibilities. And it was just such a joyous, fun, real, deep, true conversation. I know you're going to love it. Here is my conversation with Susanna Daniel. Welcome, Susanna.
Thank you, Nadine. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh my gosh. So Catherine Newman wrote her Crone Sandwich newsletter on Substack, recommended your book, said that she had blurbed it. And I mean, that was all I needed. Anything that Catherine Newman says, I'm like, yes, Catherine's been on this.
I feel the same way. I comb through her newsletters. I click on everything. Sometimes I'll write her back and be like, now what was the name of that thing you recommended again? I can't find it. And she's like, yes.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I was like, say no more. Purchase the book immediately. I was lying in bed. My husband was like, what's going on? Because I'm an early bedtime person. And this was like 10:30 going on 11. I'm still up. He falls asleep, wakes back up at 1 a.m. to go to the bathroom. I'm still reading. And it's a weeknight. And he's like, what is happening? Right,
that is such a nice compliment.
Thank you. The next morning, so I finally had to go to bed at one point, didn't want to. The next morning, I think I had like three chapters left, and I am a wake up, go to my desk, write, go work out kind of person. I stayed in bed, and he's like, now really, what's happening? Dear listener, if you have not bought this book yet, Girlfriending, you must go out and buy it now. But Susanna, for anyone who doesn't know the premise, maybe you can share with us what it's about.
Sure. It's about a 47-year-old perimenopausal mom of two who is recently out of the closet and has been dating women for a while, but has just had a very terrible breakup. Like, she's just been dumped really by somebody she didn't date for very long, but she has gone off the deep end psychologically over it. And her best friend tells her, hey, you know what you should do? You should go on 10 first dates. So the book follows her on her 10 first dates after this heartbreak and all the different things that she tries to do to get over it, like the tarot and the Reiki and the, I actually had a breakup coach in real life, but that's not on the page.
Who knew there was such a thing, but I understand why.
Yeah, there is such a thing. Yeah. And I wrote the book sort of while in the midst of that emotional turmoil, not right when it started, but somewhat far in. And the difference between the book and my life, well, there are a lot of differences, but one is that I probably went on 25 first dates. Yes. 10 would have been really abstemious for me. I attacked dating like it was my job. And for the most part, that was a good experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've said that this is autofiction and that there are many parts of it that do parallel your own life, other parts that don't. Right. So maybe you can walk us through, start from the beginning. What prompted you to start writing from real life? Like, when did this begin? What prompted it?
Every morning I go on a walk with my dog and I talk to my best friend, and she's the writer Curtis Sittenfeld, and she knows a lot about writing. She's written 9 best-selling books. She's just one of the most, I don't want to say disciplined because that sounds hard-edged, but she just like lives her values and she lives her like writing life very thoroughly. And so I've always really admired all of that. And when she gives me writing advice, I take it. Yeah. Or I try to.
Yeah.
And after kind of talking her ear off about this breakup for a while, she said, Zena, I just don't know why you're not writing about this. And I said, well, it's kind of writing. It's like writing from an open scar instead of a healed wound, you know, as they say. And she was like, you know, there's actually a lot to be said from writing from the scar. I mean, you're writing something about what you're going through now. You know, it's like there is, people journal for a reason. I don't, but. You know, people do. And I didn't want to write a journal, but I wanted to write something that really captured the depth of the turmoil that I felt. And so I wrote a short story because that's how I gotten myself into all of my books. I've written a short story and then I said, okay, I have more to say. And I wrote the short story and it got some attention. It got published and it got some attention. It got an award. And all through that, I just kept thinking, well, I'm going to write about that date. Then I'm going to write about this date. Then I'm going to write about this date. And, you know, meanwhile, my life was going on. You know, my kids, we were going on like little breaks. I was having both wonderful connective moments with my ex-husband and also conflict with my ex-husband. We were much newer to the divorce game than we are now. So we were still working some stuff out, especially emotionally. And I just felt like if I don't get some of this down on the page, whether or not it gets published, I'm going to regret it because this is a really fertile time of my life. I'm feeling the change. I'm feeling it every day. And I'm going to say in the book, like as unsettled and like as much as my world was kind of rocked by this dumping that I received, I was also like experiencing some of the sort of richest joy of my adult life too. So I knew that there was something going on inside me that really I wanted to capture.
And that's what I think drew me so much to the page is that I could see a woman who was free. That's what I could feel, that I could feel this freedom of what do I like? What do I need? What do I want? What do I want to do right now? And it felt so captivating to read that. Especially, you know, when we're in midlife as moms, there's a lot of weight and responsibility. And it seems sometimes like our selves go very dormant. And so it felt like this character was reawakening and rediscovering her core self.
Yeah, she's coming back. She was coming back from a marriage in which she didn't feel free and an episode of parenting, you know, the long parenting of the younger kids where she didn't feel free, and then she was feeling free. And I'll tell you, right after I finished this, my oldest kid started driving. There is nothing like this. It's like kindergarten all over again. You are going to be so happy.
And all I can think about, though, is my terror. I'm like, dear God.
Right. I think it depends on the kid with the terror, because I knew this kid was like stopping at every stop sign, crossing every T, you know, but my next one, we'll see. But
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, if you don't realize that your life is getting better, you know, and like getting freer, then, you know, you might actually feel stuck for a lot longer than you need to. And about 6 months after I started writing this book, it's about a breakup, it really isn't a breakup because it's not even a relationship, but it's like a 9-week relationship, not even in real life. But about 6 months after I started writing, Taylor Swift came out with 34 songs about Maddie Healy. And that was a 2-week relationship. And I was like, it literally gave me the confidence to keep going. Because there's like pieces inside you that are like, can I tell this story? Is the story valid? Why is the story valid? Is it just my story, or can it relate to people? And I'm so glad that it does relate to people, like you've said. But there was part of me that was like, I'm being silly, you know? And then I'm like a big Swiftie, and that album means a lot to me for many reasons. And it just gave me this like feeling of permission. And so I just went for it. And I was like, I'm going to, not only is this like something that I'm doing to help myself heal, but this is going to be a book, and I'm going to get this damn thing published.
I mean, you know, as a writing coach yourself, but I feel this way so much when I'm talking to women writers, that these are the exact questions that come up all the time. Is this story even relatable? Does this seem ridiculous? Who am I to write this story? Can I even write this? Do I have permission? And so often we think we're alone in whatever we're going through, and then someone else talks about it, sings about it, writes about it, and we're like, oh, okay. And when I was reading about the breakup with Z, even though it was a short-lived relationship, Z is the character in the novel, with whom the narrator had dated for a short time, I think we've all had that person where the time together was short, but the way that the exit happened was really detrimental. Either there was a ghosting, or there was just a swiftness, and it makes somebody feel like they don't matter, or that they're like repulsive in some way. There's like this such rejection that can happen. And so when I was reading on the page about the narrator going through this grieving over a relationship that was short, and that maybe from the outside people are like, what's the big deal? Like, it made total sense to me.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Yeah, I think that there's like a weird alchemy with breakups where, you know, some of them just hit a funny bone, really hit us where it hurts. And that's not the person's fault. You know, that's not Z's fault. That's just about who we are and where we are at the moment. And you know what's amazing is that I know you've been married for a long time, but it's amazing that a person can go through a head over, like a something that can just throw them for a loop at 47 years old. Like, I just think that's amazing. And it just says so much about like midlife and about the potential and aging and about what a rich experience it can be. I'm glad I'm gonna put myself out there. If you've gotten dumped, then you've been brave.
Yes, I love that. Even when I'm talking to writers, I'm like, okay, if you got a rejection, that means you're submitting. Like, there's a totally different way to look at this. And so you started writing about these dates. What made you switch, say, from memoir to deciding that it would be a novel?
Oh, I think I always knew it was going to be a novel. I wanted the best friend to be like kind of an amalgamation of a few people in my life, plus invented. I wanted there to be a through line that is entirely invented, which I won't mention, but unless you want me to. But and then I also wanted the narrator's brother to be an internet famous therapist, like Therapy Jeff. on Instagram, who I follow religiously, especially during that time of my life. I really just wanted Therapy Jeff to be my brother. So I was like, from the beginning, I made him my brother. And it's funny because my actual brother, who's a corporate litigator, otherwise biographically the same as the brother on the page, but he actually is kind of my relationship therapist. And he did give me a lot of the advice that Therapy gives people and that the therapist in the book gives people. So it's not as far from life as you'd think, but it's definitely not memoir. No, I've had very close friends be like, why didn't she publish this as memoir? And I'm like, there is stuff in here that's not true. A couple of the dates are made up.
Yeah. Okay. So from the get-go, you knew that there would be fictionalizing. But as it got closer to, say, pub date or, you know, even just thinking about publishing in general, mm-hmm. you said before we got started that the almost kind of vetting and the whole process was very different from your other two published novels than from this. Yeah. So what did that look like?
Yeah, the writing process was really different. First of all, like it just, I mean, this is kind of an obnoxious thing for any writer to say, but it came out very easily. It gave me a lot of joy. It felt kind of like it plotted itself naturally. It had, you know, so there are things as a writer you can do to make, you know, as you know, like life easier. Okay, you can give yourself a structure like a 10 days.
Yep.
You can give yourself a clock that's limited, like this is under a year, and so on. So there's just a lot of things just kind of fell into place for this book. But the other thing is that when I'm writing an entirely or an almost entire, no novel is entirely invented, but let's say that autofiction is 70-30, which I read the other day, and I was like, that's a crazy number. Like, where did they get that? Where is the double blind study on this? Like, is this self-reported? What is going on? And then I was like, okay, 70-30, that's fine.
Yeah.
So like, let's say my other books were like 90-10. Uh-huh. I think that I felt much, much more possessive of the writing process. Like the creative process, I felt like I could psych myself out at any moment by thinking too much about the end result.
Yeah.
And I've never felt that way before.
Mm.
If I got ahead of myself. So we know that we have to like keep our editors in the waiting room. We have to be like really kind to them. They're not jerks. They're just impatient, right? Like we're going to need them, right? So I had to really, really, really ask my editors to just wait, to please wait until I was completely done. Because I knew that if I started thinking about the people I was rendering on the page, the facts I was rendering on the page and all of that before it was time, I would psych myself out.
Yeah.
So I wrote an entire draft and I revised an entire draft. I took out tons of stuff. One thing I took out like consistently was anything that was kind of at the margins of a person's character. There was like one thing about my ex that felt prejudicial. It felt like, sure, maybe he'd done it, but it's not characteristic of him, right?
Yeah.
So like, I want to characterize people like in the meaty middle of who they are, not at their margins.
Yeah.
So I kind of went through thinking of that. I went through thinking of anything that would be prejudicial, any kind of detail that would identify anyone, first of all, because I do live in a small community. And, you know, and I just kind of did that after being completely done for a few times. And then I was like, well, the next step would normally be to go to my agent because it's ready, right? Like I've had paper readers, it's ready. But I couldn't do that until I actually showed it to a few people. So that was totally different. The only things I had shown, you know, other than beta readers who are just these trusted readers who are really just there as editorial support. The only thing I had done with my other books was to make sure like I'd had doctors read portions that were medical. I had painters read portions that were about art, you know, stuff like that. So this was a totally new thing for me. And I just, you know, when something's new to you, you just admit it. You're like, I don't know what I'm doing here, but this is the deal. So I gave the whole book to Z. I gave the whole book to my ex-husband. And then I took the date chapters and gave them to the dates.
Wow. Okay. I'm fascinated by this. What was the text or email like when you're like, hey, like what were you asking them to do? Because I think this is a very careful thing. You even said in your acknowledgments, like I never asked for permission, but you did know that you wanted to let them have a look. Mm-hmm. So what is it that you said to them as you handed it over?
I said, this is weird. It's going to feel weird. I've never done this before.
I just like that as a start. So this is weird.
So this is going to be the weirdest email you get today. And then I said, please let me know if there's anything in here that you do not feel comfortable with me publishing. So I would say it was like a pretty generous ask.
Yeah.
Because my feeling as a writer is like somebody asks you to change something, you go, okay, I'll make it better. Mm-hmm. Right? Like that is what we always have to do. And so many people don't write because they're afraid of being asked to change things. They're like, oh, I could never do that because my mom wouldn't want me to change this. And my feeling is you write it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, like I said, you think, where's this really going to hit somebody where it hurts? I don't want to do that. That's not what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
This isn't a hit piece. Am I looking to hit below the belt? You take anything like that out. There were a couple things that I had put in there kind of as a jerk that I took out.
Yeah.
And then you ask the people. And I'll tell you, people are incredibly generous. Every single person had something they wanted to change. They had good reasons. None of it was unreasonable. Mm. It changed every single thing.
Wow.
And I would have expected a lot more requests from each person.
Wow.
Which I did not say. Mm-hmm. I wasn't like, really? Only this? Okay. I was just like, yeah, okay, here we go. Got it.
It's like negotiating real estate with some, you know, between the buyer and the seller. You're like, oh, okay, that's all you're asking for from the inspection report? Sounds good to me. Sounds good.
Yeah. Get the hell out of here and sign on the dotted line.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was able to make those changes relatively easily.
What was it like giving it to Z? That's who I wonder. Well, I think the two people that I'm like, ooh, I could imagine the flutters would be your ex since you have to co-parent still. And then Z, since that's kind of the through line of this breakup. Caused a lot of pain, breakup, you know, in whatever it was, but this ending caused a lot of pain. So were those the two you were most kind of fluttery about? Or maybe you weren't fluttery? I don't know.
I wasn't.
Oh, what I would give.
Because I was like, I'm doing something that, you know, kind of, if you look at it from a certain angle, from a certain distance, you could see it being like a terrible thing. Like this woman is doing a terrible thing, right? Like that's a certain way of looking at it. But I knew that I wasn't.
Oh, yeah. No, not at all.
I felt confident in the compassion I brought to the page. I just wanted people to double check me, you know?
Yeah. And
Mm-hmm.
I think you were beautifully dimensional and empathetic on the page to each character. I guess I just meant more because those two characters have a more real estate on the page. I guess that is what I was getting at in terms of the flutters of, oh, you play a fair role in this novel, just a heads up. That's what makes me more fluttery. Not at all that you did them an injustice at all. I think it was really dimensional.
Well, I can't really speak to Z because I don't have a relationship with her. So I don't really feel like I should talk about her.
Yeah.
Really the whole thing there is that I sent it to her. She was super gracious, asked for a couple changes because they were sort of too identifiable.
Yeah.
I made the changes, let her know. She was like, great, thanks. That's it.
Yeah.
That's the whole story. And then with my ex, John, like I trust him and he has always been a big fan of my writing. So I knew that he would be maybe a little grumpy about it, but I knew he'd be fair. I knew it. I completely trusted him to be fair. So he came back and he was like, I have one thing I'd like you to change. And I was like, serious? And he said, yeah, it's all true. It all feels real. It was, as I said, it was a bumpy year.
Yeah.
But a divorce is a long thing.
Yeah.
And actually, in real life, we had been broken up for 6 years when I wrote the book. Mm-hmm. Now we've been broken up for almost 10 years.
Yeah.
So, and in the book, it's 3 years. So, you know, we'd had a lot of practice, but it was still kind of a bumpy year. And I put all of that in there.
Yeah.
And the biggest thing, and I feel like I relearn this lesson with John every year. And I think the biggest thing I learned on that year is that when I give him the benefit of the doubt and when I bring a feeling of good energy and positive energy to our relationship, it works. And when I bring kind of negativity to the relationship, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I don't know, you know, he's doing his own things on his end, but
yeah,
I also want to be a divorce coach. Because it is not easy. But it can be done. It can be done. And it's like so much better
The
way, you know, that some people do it. That it's so much better for everybody.
Yeah. You definitely show on the page how how the narrator interacts are very much trying to co-parent in a really beautiful way.
Which we fall short of all the time. But we keep trying.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what shows on the page. Well, I was just thinking of this whole like sharing pages with real life characters. When I was working on my memoir, it was mostly about infertility. It's called Of This Much, I'm Sure. And so as it was getting closer to like, this is really going to happen with a publisher, I was like, oh, shit, I've got to show this to my mother. And she knew that I was writing about my husband and I and 2 years of infertility and IVF cycles that didn't work and near-death experience that resulted from an IVF procedure and all this stuff. And so she knew I was writing that. And so I think she assumed that she would play less of a role on the page than she did. And even I did going into it. I thought that my mom would just kind of come in and out, given that I'm writing about wanting to be a mother. I just thought, you know, I'd mention her here and there. But then I found that as I was writing about wanting to be a mother, just this whole idea of mothering just came up more and more and more. And so I was like, oh, she's got to read this. And my son was around maybe three at the time. And I asked her to come over and I was going to go write. So I asked her if she could watch him for a couple hours. And I said, I have the manuscript and I would love for you, once you get home, I would love for you to take some time and read the whole thing. And just forewarning, it might be really emotional to kind of revisit some moments from our past. But if you read the whole way through, you'll really see the evolution that we lived. I tried really hard to represent it on the page, like the full evolution from hard moments to really strong moments. And I said, so wait till you get home and take some time with it. And then we'll talk after. Well, I go to Starbucks to write and I get a call like 15 minutes later. And she's like, yeah, you need to come home. And I was like, oh, shit. And I get home and she has her purse on her shoulder. She has her shoes on her feet. She has tears in her eyes. And she's like, yeah, I started reading and I'm just, this is really difficult. And I was like, oh, crap. And I was like, but I had to just kind of keep this centeredness and be like, yeah, I'm sure it is hard. Please read the whole thing.
Right.
And then let's talk. And usually we would speak every day or every other day. We didn't speak for that whole week. And then I got a text and she was like, I'm ready to talk. And we went for a walk together and I was like really nervous. And she had a list of notes and I was like, okay. And she brought them with her on the walk and she was like, okay, here's the first thing I'll say. And I was just kind of bracing myself and she was like, it's beautiful. And I was like, oh, you know? And then she was like, and then it brought up some really powerful conversations about things we had never discussed. And then she was like, there's one detail that isn't true. I had written about her being kind of a rebellious teenager And I, one example that I gave of her rebellion is that she had stolen this necklace from her best friend that she like wore for decades. And I was like, it just kind of showed like the kind of like free spirited teen she was. And then she goes, I have a correction to make. And she was like, I did not steal that necklace. I just took it and I did not give it back. I was like, okay, mom. Okay.
So the friend knew to whom it went. She just
as a borrow.
Okay.
She just kept it. But you know, it's like you brace yourself, or at least I do. I'll speak from my own experience. You kind of brace yourself when you're writing about real life characters. And I thought about all the things that she would maybe push back on, that I would be willing to shift or even if need be possibly take out, but it would be a discussion. And yeah, it was kind of like your thing, like there's just one thing you're like, okay.
I think we're afraid of hurting people.
Oh, so much.
And when we tell the truth about how we see them, it's gonna hurt them, even if we're not being mean. Like, my father didn't read the book till it came out because he wasn't on the page that much. And I just wasn't worried about it. And, but then of course, like when he did get it, I was like, uh-oh, should I have sent this to him beforehand? You know, I started to doubt myself. He called me after and he's like, it's your best novel. I'm loving it. The only thing is my teeth are not yellow. And I was like, well, Dad, everybody's teeth are yellow. I mean, like after, like you're 83 years old, like there's some yellow. And he's like, nope. So, you know, did it hurt his feelings that I said that, or does it hurt him at all that I remember times of our lives that weren't happy when, you know, he's in a happy place? Like, I don't know, because that's not the kind of feedback he would give me.
Yeah.
But I think when people love us, they're like willing to see themselves through our eyes because they trust us. And then it's okay.
Yeah, it is true. I mean, in the book, I wrote about how many of my childhood memories my mom is smoking because she was a smoker for multiple decades and it was a big part of growing up. And after reading that book, she was like, I never realized how prominent a role cigarettes were in your upbringing. And she made herself a vow that when the book came out, she would quit. And she has been, so that came out in 2017, so 9 years free of smoking. So it's like,
oh my God.
You know, and so she's like, it took me seeing on the page how much that was hovering over everything, literally and figuratively, that she made a big change. So you never know what will happen as a result of being seen on the page. But then as you're book was coming out and it came out, what has this been like having this story out in the world and having people receive it and love it? And what's it been like so far?
Oh, it's ideal. I couldn't be happier. Like the difference between having a book in a drawer and having a book out there is enormous. I mean, just people reading it, people loving it, people letting me know they love it. I don't know if it's necessary for those things to be a writer, but it helps me keep writing. And it makes me feel good. People here in Madison, they love the depictions of Madison. And I love that I've lived here long enough that I can like write about it with some authority and with some insideriness, you know?
Yeah.
So that's been wonderful, feeling like before I was living in Madison, but writing about South Florida. And it was like, well, are you a Madison writer? Or are you a Wisconsin writer? Are you a Midwestern writer? Who are you? And I was like, no. But now I'm like, I feel really solidly like I'm a Midwestern writer now. And people, a lot more people are heartbroken, divorced, figuring it out, you know, than you think there are. So many people are like, I related to this. I related to this. And so many married women are like, I related to this. Great married women, which really surprised me. Although it's not, it doesn't surprise me because that's the me I was working against, right? My straight married self that I was for so many years, such a huge chunk of my life. And then I wrote this book as that's not me anymore, you know? So there's a lot of that person in it, and there's a lot of the the person who is no longer in the marriage in it, who is no longer straight.
And this isn't in the book, but, and if you don't want to go here, you don't have to, but what was it like to be in a marriage and have this realization of this other self? What was that like in talking about it with your now ex? Mm-hmm. Was it a battle internally for a while? What was this like?
Do you know? Okay, so I'm 50. I was born in 75.
Yeah.
I was always bisexual. I always knew I was. Yeah. I always knew I was attracted to women.
Yeah.
But I thought like without really ever giving it too hard a stare, I think I thought, well, if I'm attracted to men, why not just be with men? And then I just got stuck. I think I just got stuck. Mm. Like I did that and then I just didn't leave. Mm-hmm. Until at this point, I often say like I'm only bisexual in that I was straight for half of my life and gay for half of my life. You know, like I feel completely gay. And yet I can't deny that there was a time in my life when I was not.
Yeah.
So did I feel, I felt that I was making a choice. And whenever you make a choice, you eliminate other options.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that that was really an untenable thing for me.
Like, was there a moment?
I can't imagine I'm alone.
What's that?
I can't imagine I'm alone in my generation.
Oh, no. No, no.
Of women who like chose to be straight and then kind of just forgot that they could have been something else.
Yeah. What was the remembering like? Like, was it like, oh, and I need to get out of this marriage? Or was it a slow like, ooh, like this is something I need to explore?
If I were to list the reasons why my marriage ended, my lesbianism would be like number 9.
That's a perfect quote.
It's there, but it's not primary.
I love it. Oh, yeah. That was so succinct. Oh my gosh. And so, gosh, I could talk to you all day, but
me too.
You are, for the reader, you are showing this woman who, as we already said, is relishing in her freedom, but is really exploring just so many assets of life. And I think that many of us in midlife almost feel like what you're talking about, we feel stuck. Like, oh, this is just how things are gonna be.
Yeah.
So what have been some of the greatest midlife joys for you?
Losing all sense of like shame or embarrassment. Like every once in a while, somebody will try to shame me about something and I'll think, oh no, I don't do that.
What got you to that place, do you think?
I think that divorce gets you there pretty fast because it's a burning down the world situation, right? Like
yeah.
In order to divorce, I mean, it's terrible. Like in order to choose to divorce, you have to be willing to walk into a burning building.
Yeah.
You have to burn it all down.
Yeah.
So you have to be willing. Like I am lucky. I got to keep so much of my life.
Yeah.
But you have to be willing to lose it. Like I had to be willing to lose my in-laws, which broke my heart. Mm. I had to be willing to lose a relationship with my ex-husband, which broke my heart. You know, you have to be willing to take a torch to your life. And after that, it's like, no big deal. You know,
yeah.
Like, everything yeah. else is no big deal.
Yes. Well, and that's what I loved about the book. You showed women in varying types of marriages where like her best friend, she's not happy in her marriage, but isn't willing to go the burn it down divorce route.
Mm-hmm. Which is very realistic and totally yeah. understandable.
Yeah, exactly. I think mm-hmm. that's what you show in the book. It's like mm-hmm. you give empathy and spotlight on where everybody, the many different places people might be at in their discontent, but the stakes maybe feel too high to divorce. Or, you know, I just really loved that you showed this wide variety of people in different stages of happiness and unhappiness and what they're willing to do about it or what they can do about it in the moment, what they won't. It just felt so real. And so maybe to close this out, I'll talk to you as a writing teacher.
Okay.
You coach people, you teach people as I do. So we have this very much in common. What advice might you give to someone who's wanting to write some auto fiction, who's just wanting to get a story on the page and they're like, I can't, or this person will think this, or, oh, this is freaking terrifying. Or what do you say to writers to get pen to page and to get them writing their story?
Well, I say that the difference between a draft and a published piece is fathoms.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's nothing you can't write in a draft.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there are things you can't publish. I am not going to say there's nothing you can't publish. There are definitely things you can't publish, and for lots of different reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard so many different reasons, really good reasons. I know how to help a person go from that first draft to something they can publish.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, to be courageous and get that first draft down on the page, it will eliminate some of that fear.
Yeah.
It will calm that flutter in your heart and that wobbliness. And then there are practical solutions. Like, a lot of people want to write about their parents and they can't.
Mm-hmm.
Because they will hurt their parents' feelings. My feeling, and this is like my number one go-to piece of advice, is you never write editorially when you're worried about how somebody's going to come off on the page, or you're worried about them reading about themselves. You write like a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
They did this. They said this. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
No slant,
mm-hmm.
no takeaway. Okay. Mm-hmm. You let the reader decide what mm-hmm. they think about that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go through that whole draft that you've written, you know, those pieces you've written completely journalistically, and you say, okay, what is the most prejudicial thing here?
Mm.
You take it out.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I love that advice. I think, yeah, I mean, I work with a lot of memoir writers, and their biggest fear is family reading it. And I, similar to you, I always say, by the time we get to a publishable draft, we don't want to have written on the page from revenge. So there shouldn't be a sense of any sort of revenge or vendetta on the page. It's simply a recounting. So it sounds very similar.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Simply a recounting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Revenge. I mean, you can write for whatever reason. Like I published a short story last year that I wrote purely out of anger,
mm-hmm.
like in the middle of the night after receiving a text.
Mm.
And then I was like, oh, you can't publish a short story that was written out of anger, can you? Yes, you can,
mm-hmm.
because you can edit it into a place that is not
mm-hmm.
purely anger, and you can take out the most prejudicial stuff, which I did,
mm-hmm.
and then it can actually be very powerful to write from anger.
Oh, yeah.
But publishing as revenge doesn't, the reader won't go for it.
Yeah.
The reader's like, nah, I don't believe you any more than anybody else. You have to prove it,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So if you're coming at it with like, my sister-in-law is an asshole or whatever, it's like the reader's like, I don't think so. I think she's fine. She just seems like a normal person. So you have to, the proof has to be very uneditorialized.
Mm. So. Yeah. So powerful. Okay. One final question that I think about a lot right now in midlife is reclamation. Like, what am I reclaiming? What are we reclaiming for ourselves, whether it be our creativity or our time or our desires? Mm-hmm. What is something that you are reclaiming these days?
I'm just going to go to logistics, and I'm going to say I'm reclaiming the right to not make dinner every night.
Yes.
I just hate it.
And
I hate it. And I have for a really long time, but I felt like a lot of embarrassment and shame that I didn't do it all the time. And now what I do at the beginning of the week is I say, these are the nights when I will have dinner for you. Uh-huh. These are the nights when I will not.
Uh-huh.
Anything can change at any time.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, I'm reclaiming like not doing stuff I don't want to do.
Yeah. My son goes to karate on Tuesday and Thursday nights. And so those are my dinner nights to cook. My husband is a trained chef. So like anything that I make in comparison, I mean, and I have no culinary skills whatsoever. And so the chef should be the one cooking the meals here because what? I hate it. I hate cooking. I always have this rosy picture in my head that I think that one day I'll become the type of person who likes cooking for her family. And I just don't. I really don't.
It's the worst. And I had a husband who was a great cook. And it gave me so much more feeling of shame and
inadequacy.
And then when we split up, I was like, you're just going to have to accept the meals at your house are not going to be as good. And once I accepted that, I was like, okay, that's fine. Yeah. And it's the deal is daddy's the cook, mama's not.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just the way it is.
Exactly. Well, and what happens is after dinner, we always have music playing and I dance. I love to dance. And my son is still at the age that I hope he never like loses, where he has no inhibitions and he just like dances really wild and free. And so we dance after dinner and I'm like, this is my role. I'm the dancer. This is my offering. I'm not the cook, but I am the dancer. And I'm going to hold that.
That's right. And I think men should take this job. Mm-hmm. So many men are so much more invested in what we eat and how good it is and whether or not it's done correctly. That's
great.
Then take it.
It's all yours.
It's all yours. Do the grocery shopping, do the deciding.
Yeah.
We'll do the other things.
Yeah. I'm glad we've gotten this squared away.
My friend Erin White wrote a piece in the New York Times about giving up dinner for her family. You should read it.
Ooh, I'll check it out.
It's pretty awesome.
You're awesome. Thank you.
You're awesome.
This has been an absolute delight. I'm totally so grateful for it.
I love it my day. Thank you so much.
Ooh, so much fun. So honest and real and deep. If you loved this conversation, please feel free to share it with a friend. And if you love Heart of the Story, don't forget to follow, subscribe, like the show so that it always comes into your feed. If you really, really love it, feel free to give us a review. It counts. It really, really helps. And I want to thank my dear producer, Michelle Rado, who always makes the show everything that it is. Remember, everyone, every heart has a story, and every story has a heart. See you next time.